In this episode of Startups to the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about how to fix your onboarding, marketing a product with a low lifetime value, and more listener questions. This is Startups to the Rest of Us, episode 382. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome in building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you built your first product, or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
Wait, you totally screwed me.
You're supposed to say you're Rob.
That was not fair. And I'm Rob, I guess. I don't know. I'm not Mike.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Now, did you hear? That's what Sherry said when she was on the show.
Yeah.
And I'm not Mike.
You got me.
Yeah. What's going on this week, man?
Well, just pushed the new Bluetech website live this week. So that's nice that that's finally out there. That went out on, I think, Monday night. And just been making some minor tweaks here and there just to get the images all straightened out and kind of smooth out some of the rough edges. So like my main focus was just getting the design itself in place and then the copy along with the new updated theme because it's all built on WordPress. And now that that stuff's in place, I actually have to leave in, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours to go to FemtoConf. And then once I get back, then I'll probably finish off the rest of the like little minor things that need to be taken care of and check to make sure all my plugins are installed and all the analytics are working. And then from there, just start marketing.
The site looks great. It looks really nice. It's like 10 times better than what you had up there. So, I mean, all the way from the look to the kind of the images to just the verbiage and in what you have there. So bravo on that. Can I give you like two small critiques? I'm sure these would be higher on your list.
Sure.
You have a testimonial on the homepage, which I think is great.
Yep. Those are going to be swapped out.
Oh, cool. You're going to have multiple, but put big old quotes around it. Like people, there's something about seeing quotes around it where I know there's a dude's, you know, there's Justin's face there and then there's a testimonial to the right of it. But without the quotes, it's like, there's just something there, right? So I really like to call out large quotes because then people know like that's guys saying that. It's a little thing that I see in a lot of sites, but I think there's some impact.
Good. Yeah, I'll definitely do that. What's the next one?
The other one is, where was I looking? Oh, you know what? This one isn't actually a critique. I really like you have a one sentence description at the bottom of the page in the footer about Bluetick. And it says, Bluetick relieves the soul deadening drudgery of email follow-up for founders, overworked sales executives, and anyone who's ever lost a perfectly good lead to the email black hole. I think that's a really well-written thing. Why does it say FIP? What's FIP mean?
I don't know, actually. I think that's got to be RIP.
Oh, okay. So there's just a little typo there.
Yep.
I think that's, your logo. I don't love your logo because it took me a while to figure out what it is, but it looks like it's a dog eating an envelope or carrying an envelope. Is that right?
Yeah, it's carrying an envelope.
Yeah, and I'm sure it looks better when it's big, but given the size on your site right now, and listeners, you should go to bluetick.io and check all this out and see if you agree with me, you know, or what else we can figure out. But I'm sure changing your logo is like priority 942 on your list right now.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason I even had the logo done was just because before it was just text and I wanted to have something up there so that when people like could kind of associate the logo with the text itself, because there's familiarity that people get with certain text fonts and especially when they go with a particular logo, but I'm going to be using that logo inside of some of the emails and stuff that are being sent out. So I just want that familiarity to at least be there. It wasn't necessarily important. It was just like, okay, if I'm doing a step up, previous logo was literally a stock image that was just like black and white of a dog's face. And it was just not very relevant, I'll say. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I would think if you could somehow simplify just the dog's face, even turn it into a line drawing or something. Again, I realize it's hard because you can't do it yourself. So you're gonna have to hire somebody, but I don't think this is a deal breaker. I don't think people are not going to sign up for the app because of that. So, but it's just something that every time I come to the site, I notice it and I'm like, huh, that's it's a little busy. The logo feels. Oh, two other things I realized. One, I know I'm going to keep going as we were talking.
This is going to turn into a website teardown episode.
It's going to be the whole episode. No, but these are very minor things, right? I mean, overall, there are no typos on the page. The copy is good. Like personal touch at scale for all your follow up emails. That's your headline. It's really well written. Obviously, you could split test that against something, but nothing comes to mind as like, boy, this copy is really jacked up or anything. It looks good. The only two, and again, these are minor things, but your drip widget popped up on me after maybe 5 to 10 seconds. And I was just like in the middle of reading your headline or the subheading and the thing popped up. So I would probably push that out to like 30 seconds. You have quite a bit of time on the page. Just give people, you know, maybe even 45 seconds. I mean, just give people a bit of time to read a little more. Last thing is your title tag on your homepage. It says home-blue-tick. So I know you're not doubling down on SEO right now, but really, I mean, Google, you know, has probably indexed you already. May want to start that with something. You know, I don't know what keyword you're going to be targeting or keywords, but whether it's email follow-up or whatever generic phrase you would love to rank number one in Google, at least have that somewhere in there, probably towards the front. Again, I wouldn't keyword stuff, but home-blue-tick isn't going to get you much, right? You don't want people to find you for the word home, and people are going to find you for the word blue tick. So neither of those really need to be there, although I'd probably still have blue tick in there somewhere, but that's about it, man.
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, all of those are great suggestions. I mean, some of them, like you said, like the typo, like I knew that I had to get to that, but I just hadn't gotten to it. I do like the extending out the drip widget a little bit so that it gives people more time. But the home, like all the title tags and stuff like that, like I have not even looked at any of those yet. So that's kind of on the list of things to do when I get back.
Yep. I like your, you have some art on the tour page that's very cartoony. Those look really cool. Mm-hmm. I like the feel of that. It's a very professional feel.
Yeah. The designer who did the website, he came up with those illustrations. We went back and forth on a couple of different design ideas that he had, and those are the ones that kind of came out of it.
Yep. Very cool, man. Well, good luck. I'm interested to hear, you know, how it impacts conversions and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the main focus of doing all of this stuff was just to give the website a lot more, a much better feel to it so that when somebody was either came to the website itself or was directed to it because of a referral, that it doesn't look like something that they would have just clicked the back button and said, no, I'm not even going to give this a chance. Because I did hear that as feedback from people where like I recommended to so-and-so and they told me that if I had not recommended it to them, that they wouldn't have even given it a second thought. So it's really to just overcome that as a primary objective. Because I can do a demo for somebody or a webinar and I could sell them on it and say, yes, this is what the product does. And by showing them inside the product and what it can do for them and solve the problems, yes, it's fine. But a completely cold lead who comes to the website has no idea. And they're not going to give it a chance is really what it is. And the bar for something like a SaaS product is much higher than, you know, it's something that the old website could even overcome.
Right. The bar is much higher than it was 5 or 10 years ago as well. And I think you've made a good call here. Doubling down on this, you're at the point where, you know, you're starting to scale and get more trials coming through the website. So now's the time to do that. If you'd spent a bunch of time on this when you were in customer development, it would have been a waste of time. So I think it was a good use of time and money. So, hey, I wanted to talk a little bit about MicroConf. It's coming up in April, starter edition. We still have tickets left and we have some really good speakers this year. We have Marie Poulin, who's talking about her first year of SaaS bootstrapping. We have Ali Blum talking about copywriting and onboarding emails. She's been on the show. You're speaking, Justin Jackson, Ben Orenstein, Cortland Allen from Indie Hackers, Moitza Mars about Facebook ads. Really solid lineup this year. If you're at all interested in hanging out with 100 to 150 folks who are all the way from, you know, idea to making a full-time living from their business, head over to microconf.com, click on starter, and the tickets are relatively inexpensive compared to most conferences, and we do still have some left, so we'd love to see you there. The other thing is I'm driving to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin next Thursday, or I guess it's 2 days after this will air, to attend GaryCon. Have you heard of that?
I have not. Is that related to Gary Gygax or Gygax?
Gygax, yep. Yeah, so Gary Gygax was a creator of Dungeons & Dragons, and he died in, I think it was, 2010, 2012, and basically like friends and family just got together and played a bunch of games. Both, it's like there's tabletop games, there's card games, it's all matter of, and RPGs and miniatures and the war games and all that kind of stuff. And it was like 20 or 30 people the first year, and they jokingly called it GaryCon, kind of in his honor. And then the next year, they sold a few tickets and they had like 100 people and it just turned into this thing. So I went last year. It's kind of neat being in the Midwest. I've never gone because I was never going to fly from California out to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. But being in the Midwest, it's like a 4 or 5 hour drive. And last year I was kind of nervous about going, you know, my son and I, we obviously love and play these games, but we're not like sophisticated gamers. We just play them for fun. And there were about 1200 people there and it was a blast, man. It was so much fun. And people were really nice and welcoming. And I'd come up with my 10-year-old son and I was like, hey, we've never played this. And they're like, no problem. We have character for you. Here's how you do it. Like they were just super helpful. So anyways, really looking forward to that. If anybody happens to listen to this and be there, please drop me a line. Would love to connect with you. But if not, I'll certainly report back about the nerdery that's going to take place in Lake Geneva next week.
That's awesome. I've been to a couple of gaming conventions like that. There was one in Buffalo, New York that I went to. I don't know. It was probably like 10 or 12 years ago. And it was interesting because there was a guy there who had a role-playing game that he was trying to launch and trying to get funding for, but he was also still doing playtesting for it. And there was a room of like 25 of us who he basically threw us into this game. And I think the game was called Monoxide Amazon or something like that. And it was like, the idea was like, you're in this world where like you just basically have to run away from everything. And like everything is out to kill you. And so like half the people died in like 10 or 15 minutes or something like that. It was like an hour long session. But like out of all of us, I think there were only 5 or 6 of us that made it out alive.
That's fun. Yeah, that's cool. And that's the neat part. Last year, same thing happened. There were several people there who were trying to get their games on Kickstarter or going to put them on, but they were doing playtesting. And so my son actually played a tower defense game, board game that he enjoyed a lot. And, you know, I mean, the conference itself it's a convention. It is 4 days. We're only going for 3 days of it. But, you know, it's not just some 8-hour session. I mean, we'll probably game as much as we can, 8 to 12 hours a day. We've already signed up for, you know, tables in advance. And then we also like wandering around. And there's so much cool stuff to buy, too. It's really bad. I need to limit my spending. But I get all overwhelmed at how much cool stuff people bring. And it's a great time to buy dice and miniatures and all kinds of geeky stuff.
Cool. So what are we talking about this week?
We have a few listener questions, and actually, by the end of this episode, we will have 0 listener questions.
Woo-hoo.
In the queue. I don't know if it's woohoo or not, or if it's
crap.
Like, uh-oh. exactly. Woohoo or oh crap. We're going to have to come up with some content next week. So anyways, all that to say, if you do have questions for us, please email them to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com, or certainly call our voicemail number, which we read at the end of every show. But our first question is from Tim Nguyen, and he has a couple questions in the same email. And his first question, he says, I was wondering, for a B2B SaaS targeting a specific niche market, what would be a good amount of traffic I should try to generate to get meaningful feedback? Aside from it depends, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, aside from it depends.
Because it does depend.
Yeah, it does depend.
This is a very general answer, but yeah, let's weigh in on it. I mean, I have some thoughts.
Yeah, I think when you ask a question like this, what you're really trying to get at is the amount of feedback that I'm getting good enough in relation to what other people would get, or are you getting the feedback that you need to make a decision? And I think that's how I would approach it, to figure out whether or not you're getting enough traffic. So like you kind of have to decide on what your KPI for that website is and how you're going to be gathering information from people. So let's say that you use Hotjar and you put a poll on your website and you get 100 or 500 people to it and you get 3 people to answer the poll. Well, that's not a very good, not only is it not a good percentage, but 3 people out of 500 visitors is not going to help you in any way, shape, or form. I mean, even just adding one answer is going to skew things in such a direction that it's just not helpful. So I think I would look at it in terms of how much feedback you're getting versus how many people are visiting, and also recognize that when you're looking at the traffic stats for a particular website, it's very easy to misinterpret bots coming to the website to just crawl it versus actual visitors who were there for a purpose or came from a particular search term or were directed from an email or another website.
If you're using Google Analytics, though, I don't think it picks up bots. I'm pretty sure it does not. It's only if you look at raw server logs, just as a caveat in there.
Yeah, but it is hard to tell when you're looking at that, because you do see like on the server logs, like you'll get 20 or 30 visits a day. And I'm not convinced that Google accurately filters out all the robots that it's supposed to.
Really? Because it's JavaScript. I mean, a bot is like a crawler, right? It's
right.
Like a Perl script or Python script that's just doing stuff. And shouldn't, in quotes, execute JavaScript. And you need to execute JavaScript to have Google Analytics track you. So I know that Google's crawler does execute some JavaScript. I mean, there's stuff. It's possible. But my guess is that most bots are not executing the Google Analytics. I don't know that they're, and I'm guessing they would exclude it if they could, you know, and they're pretty smart about that. So anyways, though, but the point is, if you're not using Google Analytics, then, and you're using your logs, they could be in there, right?
Right. Yeah, that's true. But I think what you're really, like with this particular question, what you're really trying to get at is like, what is the information that you're trying to retrieve from people, and what feedback is it that you want? Like, do you want conversations? Do you want them to comment on something? Do you want to get them on a phone call? What is the KPI that you're trying to push people towards, and then are they doing it? And I don't think it's a matter of trying to measure the actual traffic itself, because I think the bare minimum, you probably need at least 500 visitors a month. Beyond like anything below that, you're just really not going to be able to make a meaningful business out of it. The other thing to consider is the fact that not every B2B SaaS product needs to have traffic coming to its website if that's not your primary source or primary channel for marketing the product. So if you're doing outbound cold emails, for example, or if you're sending postcards in the mail to people, or you're doing cold calling, none of those things involve people coming back to your website. So there's kind of an implicit assumption here that the traffic that's coming to the website is based on like SEO or content marketing or something along those lines. So I would just be hesitant to say that there's a 100% correlation between website traffic versus being able to get that meaningful feedback. Because if you are doing cold calling, for example, you could get on a call with somebody and you can ask them questions and talk to them, get the information you need, and they never hit your website at all. So, you know, that's something to keep in mind.
Yep. I think that's probably the first point that I would make. And I think that that's something to keep in mind, is it's not about necessarily driving a bunch of traffic to a form or to an opt-in. It depends on your business idea. But boy, if you have no audience and no reach, I would probably start with some type of outbound cold email, or maybe some ads going to a landing page or something. But there's just no better way to get feedback, because that's his question here. It's not how do I build a meaningful business, it's how do I get meaningful feedback. And the way you do that is you ask for it, but it tends to have to be outbound. And so I would, you know, this concentric circle marketing I always talk about, it's like I would talk to my friends and colleagues, and then their friends and colleagues, and then their audience, and then eventually you get to the cold. But I would start, you know, the cold audiences, but I would start in the center with the people that you know, if you truly are going for feedback. In the early days of Drip, yes, I threw up a landing page and put some copy on there. But the only reason I did that was because I was going on podcasts and people were asking me about it, and I wanted somewhere to send people. And I was eventually, once I kind of knew what we were going to build, I started doing some ads to it, and I did build a list from there. But that was not the way I got meaningful feedback. The way I got meaningful feedback was a bunch of warm emails to people within my network asking them, would you use this tool? Here's a screenshot. What do you think? And then kind of started building momentum there. So I think I think that's the way to think about this. And if you want to build an actual sustainable business, and you're kind of asking about how much traffic, I mean, .NET Invoice, which was, you know, dependent on the month, but between $2,000 and $4,000 a month, pretty consistent. Sometimes it got to $5,000. That site had 1,000 to 1,500 uniques for years. And it was just a really high converting site. And it was in a vertical. And that's what he's asking about here. He's like, it's a B2B SaaS. It's in a vertical niche. So you don't need that much, but you are going to top out at some point and just stop growing. And that, you know, .NET Invoice was $300 one-time purchase. So keep that in mind as well. So, you know, with 1,500 people coming to your site, if you think about let's just throw out a 1% conversion rate to trial, you're going to get 15 people, right, into your trial funnel. And then let's assume you ask for credit card. That's with credit card up front. And then let's say you close 50% of those to customers, which is likely, then you're going to have 7 or 8 new customers a month. And so you have to ask yourself that those numbers, is that, you know, if you're charging $1,000 a month, that's probably pretty good. And if you're charging $10 a month, it's not very good. So you have to think about your price point and just think about the numbers that I threw out there. And you can kind of do backwards math and figure out how many people you need to send to figure out how fast you want to grow. Tom's second question was that he seems to be getting free trial signups, but once users get into his onboarding, which is like a getting started wizard, he seems to lose them. It's only 3 steps. It's nothing too complicated. Just adding their location, product service they provide, and setting a payment processor so they can take payments from their customer. Some seem to get to this part and never log in. Any idea why? It's driving me crazy. What would you do if you were in his shoes, Mike?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, there's no way for us to really answer, like, why that is. But I think that if I were in his shoes and I was having this particular problem, I would email those people individually who never got past that point and see if you can help them, either just walk them through it or ask them questions about what their experience was. Like, your best case scenario is to get them onto a call to walk them through it and do, like, a personalized onboarding session and then watch them as they go through it. So you could just use Zoom to kind of watch over their shoulder as they go through. And the nice thing about doing that is if you do it for them, then they see it. But if you let them do it, because they don't know exactly what they're doing, they're going to click on stuff that they shouldn't. And you're going to be able to recognize that and say, oh, why did that person click there? And you can ask them literally on the call, why did you click on that? Or what was it that made you think that you were supposed to click on that? Maybe they're getting confused about the UI. Maybe they just don't have time to log in, so they never set up their account. You know, I think there's other questions I would also ask about, like, do they come in to the site and get there, or do they just never come in? Like, if they've gone through the sign up, does it take them directly over to this, you know, like, this three-step process, or do they have to, like, get an email and then they click on the email and then they come back into the application? Like, how is that sequence of events set up, and what's the flow look like for that end user? Because it could very well be that, you know, some people, depending on their browser, for example, and I've run into this with Bluetick in certain situations where some browsers on occasion do not work, and it had to do with, like, a race condition inside the JavaScript code. So some things worked fine and then other ones didn't. And I didn't know that because I wasn't monitoring exactly what browsers people were using. And like I said, because it was a race condition, it sometimes happened, but not always. So you really just need to talk to them and watch over their shoulder to watch them go through that and ask those questions to find out what it is that they're doing. And if they already got through that first step, they signed up, you have their email address, or at least presumably you should, and contact them and follow up with them until you get an answer as to why they didn't go through that next step. Maybe they realized at that point that it was going to be more work than to set up than they thought it was. And, you know, at that point you have to evaluate, do I put this process in place? Do I need them to do those three things all at once? Could I spread it out? Are there ways to interject that as part of them using the product without forcing them through that concrete step all up front? So let's say that the location, for example, like, could you pull that from their,
like, their IP
credit card information? Well, yeah, I mean, that too, like, it depends on what, like, how accurate you need it to be.
Yep.
So, like, time zone, for example, you could probably pull it from somebody's browser. If you need the address, could you pull it from their credit card? And that depends on whether or not you're taking credit card up front, which sounds like it's not because it's a free trial. So those are the places I would start.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. The one other thing I would consider is taking away self-service sign up and just putting a request a demo button, you know, and allow people, I mean, when they hit that, they can just book right in Calendly and set something up. You could even try to be, I mean, if you really want to do this well, and this is what you're focused on, the request a demo button, like, you could respond to that within minutes. I've seen companies where, I mean, if you're relatively low traffic and you really are just hacking away all day right now, try to get back to people within like 10 minutes of them clicking that. And just get them on the phone and, you know, obviously a Zoom meeting and do a screen share and walk them through. And it's essentially what you said, Mike, but I'm just saying you take away the self-service sign-up portion. And I think that right now it's going to be about talking to customers. It sounds like he's still in the early days. I mean, you could throw Hotjar on there and do screen recordings. You could throw Crazy Egg on there and get heat maps. You can do all that stuff, but it's, you're never going to find out why. You're just going to see what is happening. And the why is obtained through having a conversation with them. So I would be more hands-on in these early days. You don't have to do that forever, but I think you'll certainly find out that it's pretty valuable for your learning, for accelerating your learning in these early days. His last question was for you, Mike. He says, I was listening to one of the podcasts, and Mike was saying Bluetick.io was having usability issues he had to fix. Are you able to get into detail? Just curious as to what some of them are. And I recall you talking about one usability issue. Interested in talking about that?
Sure. So the main usability issue that I have addressed over the past, I don't know, like 6 months or so was it had to do with onboarding. So when somebody signs up for Bluetick, one of the first things that you have to do is you have to set up your mailbox and you have to add in like your username and password. And if you're using Gmail, there's all these different settings that you have to connect. So you have to have like the IMAP server host name, the username, password, port number, the encryption level, and then you also have to have the exact same information for your SMTP server because it may not be the same. So initially, like, I had a setup page where you had to set up your mailbox, and there were probably like a dozen different settings. So what I would do is I would do personalized onboarding for each person, walk them through it, watch the back end, like, because not everybody knows what ports they're using for their mail server. And it may not, like, some people are technical, some people are not. And so I'd walk through it with them. And then I got to a point where I knew that certain types of mail servers were very common. So like if you're using Gmail or Google Apps, like I could guess at what those are, because like it's always going to be imap.gmail.com and then also smtp.gmail.com. But your username and password are going to be different. So I could basically filter out a bunch of those, and I was able to shorten down the page itself. But in addition to that, there were still problems, because you have to either, if you have two-factor authentication set up or you don't, like you either have to enable less secure apps, or you have to enable two-factor authentication, and you also have to make sure that IMAP is enabled. So it's like, over time, I kind of whittled down the number of things that somebody had to do to get their mailbox set up. And at some point, I kind of transitioned to the point where if you are using Google Apps or G Suite, as I call it now, like you can just click through and go through the OAuth authentication. And that basically takes care of everything for you. You just put in your username and password in Google, click the button, and boom, everything is kind of taken care of for you. So it was very much a progression where I slowly pulled myself out of the setup process. But like on day one, like I didn't necessarily know what everybody needed, and I didn't have everything coded. So I push myself into the process to make sure that it got done.
Right, and I think that's a great way to do it. I mean, we had several integrations in Drip that were kind of a pain in the butt to set up. You had to go and install a webhook and do all this and that. And we've been going back as we've grown and scaled and making them all OAuth if the provider allows OAuth. And we always called it our V1. You know, V1 integration was just to plug in, and then V2 was to add OAuth, and V3 was to make the triggers native. You know, there were all these things, and we just had that, you know, the verbiage or the language that we all knew on the dev team. And you have been in your early days, right? It's like customer development time. And you could have spent another 3 weeks in the early days making it super simple, but you didn't need to because you were walking people through it. And so I think that, I guess this is technically a usability issue, but it's like a deliberate decision to move faster and then circle back and iterate. And I think that's something that people should keep in mind as you're building your apps. It's like, it doesn't need to be the best all the time. You got to do your best. You want your code to have not a lot of cruft and not have technical debt. So I wouldn't skimp on that. But when you're moving fast, I think making a first pass through and having the usability in some areas be not as ideal as maybe you'd like, and you know that, and you plan to come back, I think that's a pretty good approach.
Yeah, the other thing that I used specifically to, and like in this particular case, which people might find useful, is that I made this decision for this piece of it specifically because it was a setup piece. And I knew that it was something that most customers are only ever going to do once. And once it's done, that's the end of it. So even if it takes me 30 minutes or 45 minutes on a call to set somebody up and get that stuff connected properly, it doesn't matter because it won't have to be done again. You know, obviously, I don't want to be on a call with every single person for 45 minutes just to get them set up. And then after that, try to do some level of onboarding and customer development. But if I can get that stuff taken care of like later on, I basically just kicked it down the road because it was that one time setup and it wasn't going to have to be done again. So if that's that you can use that as a deciding factor as to where you're going to spend your time. And I see a lot of other vendors doing this where if certain things are painful, you tend to find those things in places where the customer doesn't have to do it very often. And the one example that comes to mind is Oracle's installer, which for like 10 to 15 years was busted. It was fundamentally broken on Windows. You literally could not install Oracle without it failing and then having to go in and like fix stuff. And they finally fixed it in like 2012 or something like that. But for a long time, it did not work at all.
I remember that. That was crazy. All right. Our next question is about cold email. It's from Greg Ristow from utheory.com. He says, love the show. I've got a startup music theory learning site. It's the letter U and then the word theory.com, utheory.com, which is just now at $1,500 per month in revenue with very little marketing. Congratulations, by the way, that's a nice mark to hit. Starting to think about email marketing strategies for reaching college music theory faculty and high school music teachers, and I'm wondering about the legality of gathering names and emails from school websites. When I look around the web, I seem to get conflicting information on how CAN spam applies. And that's a law in the US about not spamming people that defines spam. And I know in my own day job as a college music faculty member, I regularly get emails from companies who pulled my email from my school's website. Any advice? Mike, I know you have a lot of thoughts on this. Care to allow? I'd say give a short answer and then a longer answer.
Yeah. So the shorter answer is that it is legal to go to somebody's website and pull the email addresses. And at that point, depending on how you email them, that's where like the piece of can spam falls into place. It's not about whether or not you pull the emails from the website or whether you gather their contact information. It's really about what you do with it after the fact. And underneath the umbrella of the Can Spam Act, there's basically three different types of emails that are sent out. There's commercial emails, there's transactional emails or relationship emails, and then there's other. So I'll talk about those in a minute, but most of what Can Spam basically says is don't lie to people or forge header information when you're sending emails and try to hide what it is that you're trying to do. So for example, your from email address should actually be you or your business. Who it's to should be that person. Don't be forging emails to people. Like if I were to send an email to you and I said that it forged the header information, said that it was Bill Gates, then it starts to fall under the can spam laws. So lying about those things, not specifying that something's an advertisement or lying about what the subject is. So let's say that you say that it's about your recent payment, and then in the body of the email, you're saying like it's a Viagra commercial or advertisement. Like that right there is a violation of can spam because you've not said that it's an advertisement, and you've also lied in the subject line. Not telling people how to opt out of future emails, that's another one, and then honoring the opt-outs. A lot of those things are typically handled by an email service provider, so those are things that you don't typically have to worry about. Going back to the three pieces of the three different categories of email that are defined here, there's the commercial intent, which basically is an advertisement of some kind. That's really where the pieces of the Can Spam Act are that you need to pay attention to. So if you're advertising a product or a service and you're promoting it and you're sending emails to these people and it's very clearly that you're trying to get them to sign up for a service, that is a commercial intent email. If it's a transactional email, that essentially is exemplified by things like somebody comes to your website, buys something, and then you send them a receipt. Well, emailing them the receipt, that's a transactional email because they did something and then they receive that receipt based on what they did. The third one is other. And this is kind of where you get into a very, very gray area because all three of these things are all about the primary purpose of the message. What is it that that email was intended to do and what are the contents of it? So if I send somebody an email that is completely unsolicited and it's got links in it for them to buy my service or to come to my website and look at the product to learn more because I'm essentially pitching it to them and saying, hey, would you like to learn more about this? Here's the website. That is more of commercial content. If I email somebody and I say, hey, I'd like to talk to you about X because I'm exploring this idea or I have a product and I'm doing some customer development, that is not commercial because you're not actively selling them something. There's not an advertisement in it. And it's also not transactional. So what happens is that those types of emails fall under other. And I will put a blanket categorization here that says, I'm not a lawyer. So just take some of this with a little bit of interpretation and a grain of salt because like this isn't legal advice. But my reading of all of these things is that commercial content, the transactional and other, like you can essentially leverage those three. And depending on what it is that you're putting in the email, a lot of times you can force it to fall underneath the other category, which essentially says that it doesn't need to follow these can spam laws and regulations.
Yep. So I think the TLDR on that, again, we're not lawyers, we can't give legal advice, but it is generally accepted practice that yes, people do scrape, emails from websites, whether they gather them by hand or whether they have a VA do it or whether they write a script to do it. And it is legal to cold email people, even for commercial purposes. I receive them all the time. And while I may morally or ethically consider them spam, and certain people do, and they say, you're spamming me, based on the legal definition, that's not. Now, I would give you the advice, don't use a bulk email program. You'll get shut down. If you were to import, scrape that list and then import it into Drip or MailChimp or anywhere, we'll block your account. because the spam flag rates, people will spam, mark them as spam. There's going to be bounces. There's going to be, people are not going to open them, and they're just going to have low engagement. And those cold emails should not be in a tool like a Drip or a MailChimp. They should be in a tool more like Yesware or Bluetick. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct. And part of the reason, like the interesting thing there is that the reason that like Drip and AWeber and MailChimp and all those others are stopping people from sending those types of emails and stopping them from importing the lists and blasting them out is because what happens is that the people on the receiving end of it, if they don't like the message, they can mark it as spam. And that's not a legal definition of that it was spam. It was that that person classified it as spam. And what happens is that that then negatively impacts the provider. So in that case, like they're protecting not only themselves, but also all of the other customers that they have. So let's say that I imported 1,000 emails in a Drip and it's, I basically blast something out. And then a lot of them start getting marked as spam. Well, I am then thereby impacting the rest of Drip's customers, which obviously is a no-no, and I would expect them to shut me down. Versus if you send it out through Yesware or Bluetick or all these other things, what happens in those cases is that would, if somebody reports it as spam, it actually goes against your own domain as opposed to somebody else's. So from my standpoint, like if you're going to basically bash your own domain and you really are spamming people and it is classified as spam, then you're negatively affecting your own domains, not mine, not any other customer. So at that point, it doesn't impact me as much. But the providers, the email service providers, the reason they're doing it is not for legal reasons. It's to essentially protect their current customer base and the send rates and deliverability of everything else that they're doing.
That's right, because it's shared IPs and shared sending domains. All right. Well, we are at time, sir. And at the start of the show, I said we'd get through all the questions, but we did not. We have one question in the hopper for a future episode. So we will revisit that at some point. But you want to wrap us up for today?
Sure. Was that a deliberate like lengthening of the episode to make sure that we had the one left or no?
No, it wasn't. I figured we would get to all of them. I mean, we didn't have that many questions, but obviously some of the answers were, you know, more in depth. And we just ran a little long today.
Well, if you have questions for us, you can call it into our voicemail number, 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforthestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupsforthestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.